Hello, I'm Jason Solomons. Welcome back to Film Weekly. This week we hear from the Tribeca Film Festival in New York, where two of the city's most celebrated cinematic sons have new films, Woody Allen and Spike Lee. I dip into East End gangster folklore with the Collins sisters and their new documentary, The End. And I'll be reviewing more of this week's UK releases, including Michael Caine in Is Anybody There? And Hugh Jackman in X-Men Origins, Wolverine. Yes, it's sharper than an adamantium claw. It's Film Weekly. If you think about it, British gangster films can hold their own against the best from America. From The Long Good Friday to Sexy Beast, from The Lavender Hill Mob to Get Carter, and even Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. But the real-life stories of London's gangland figures are perhaps just as eye-opening as the films. Nicola and Tina Collins grew up with the most feared of gangland figures as their family. The twin sisters' first film, The End, is a documentary that takes an intimate look at their father and his gangland pals as they are today. And before we talk to the Collins sisters, let's hear a clip from The End.
There's been a lot of people out in East England right to the top. But 9 out of 10 of those people, somewhere along the line, started off doing a little bit of villainy. And I don't blame them for that, because I know what it was like. I was there.
That's Les Falco talking about the breeding ground for gangsters that was at the East End. And I'm delighted to say that the girls behind that documentary, Nicola and Tina Collins, join me in the Film Weekly studio now. Congratulations on your film, The End. It is your feature debut. Nicola, if I can start with you, because you're the director.
Yes.
How did you decide that this was the way in for your first movie?
Well, I live in Los Angeles and I've been there for 6 years. And when I knew I was ready to make a documentary film, you start looking around for your inspiration, you know. And it's funny because it always brought me back to the place where I grew up and these guys that I knew growing up. And a lot of them were dying. You know, that's why I called it The End, because it really is the end of an era,
right.
You know. And so I thought, I want to get them on camera real quick and if they'll agree to do it.
Yeah, was that the difficulty? Because it seems to me that apart from the film itself, the great story is that what happened sort of backstage to kind of get these guys on camera must have been half the battle. I don't know if you, Tina, as producer, were involved in that as much as
Nicola.
Well,
I think Nick really was the persuader. She really persuaded Dad. and then once he agreed, it was like a scheduling nightmare, to be honest with you. So we just flew back straight away before anyone changed their minds. And then it was just like a day-by-day basis because some of the guys kept dropping out. And then, you know, I think they're just changed their mind a little, and then they'll say, oh, I'll do it on Wednesday, and then, you know, on Wednesday would come and they'll be like, oh, I've got to do this, I'll do it on, you know. So it was a little bit of a nightmare.
And did they do it ultimately, Tina, because they knew it was you?
Yeah, and my dad, I think, as well. And then also once one of the guys did it that they knew, you know, then they'd come on board. So the more that we had, the more would come.
So it's like casting in Hollywood, and they say, well, you know, once Robert De Niro
exactly.
was attached, everyone else fell in.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I mean, Robert De Niro, who comes up as like all of these guys' favourite actor,
I know.
And one by one is hilarious, really. And your dad, Les, he kind of must model himself on De Niro, certainly Goodfellas, the slick back hair, the very dapper tie. Looks like Robert De Niro's character in Goodfellas.
You know, it's funny. But it's funny, I think my dad came out the womb looking like that. I can't remember a time when he isn't smart and dapper and, you know, his shoes are polished. It's just the way he is.
Right. I mean, let's talk about the sort of difficulty of perhaps why these guys didn't want to go on camera. Is it because they did feel that they might be incriminating themselves, making themselves public?
Yeah, you know, I really think that these guys, they don't want any praise. They don't, you know, they don't want to be famous through their actions, which is, you know, very different to some guys out there that call themselves gangsters, I think. So I really said to them as well that the East End is going to be a character in this film, you know, as much as the guys are. And that's really what drew them to it, I think, because they love the East End of London so much.
And they seem to like being part of the folklore of the East End. I mean, there's pictures of Mickey Goldtooth kind of underneath the pictures of the Cray twins. You know, it's that kind of legacy that they form part of. And I think they seem to feel very proud of that, don't they?
Yeah, I think, you know, for them it was a moment in time. It was, you know, a slice of history. I think from something so small, it's such a small place in the world, it's inspired so much. I mean, people in America are watching films on Cockney gangsters and loving it and reciting it. And I think even actually in Hollywood, there's some Brits that come out there and they make out that they're Cockney. They walk, you know, it's become a real cool thing now.
That's Hugh Grant. It never worked for him quite.
No, it didn't. Yeah.
When did you find out that your dad was a gangster?
I think really we found out from other people, you know, at school, other people would tell us stories.
It's a really hard question to answer, actually, that, yeah.
Is there a moment, did you think, were you bullied once and someone went, don't touch the Collins girls?
Yeah. Actually, our headmaster at school was pretty mean to us for some reason. We were stood up in front of the whole class and asked, who likes the Collins twins? And it was the most mortifying moment of my life.
I think we were both like hyperventilating, crying.
Yeah,
and we
can't remember
what
it was for.
And amongst the kids, so we looked like they were all looking at us like we were weird because we were like, you know, crying our eyes out.
And yeah, the headmaster was just really mean. And I remember going home and crying to mum and dad. And I remember dad just looking very calm. You know, his blood pressure never changed, and he said, "Don't worry, it'll never happen again." And we remember going into school the next morning, and the headmaster used to play the piano, very animated, you know, he loved it. And we walked in and he was hitting all the wrong notes on the piano, and, you know, he kind of looked a bit mentally tortured.
He was trying to clean his glasses and he had no puff, you know. He never looked at us again in the eye, so.
Yeah. So I suppose that's the moment we knew Dad was a little different.
Okay,
yeah.
That's a lovely story. Thank you very much. What I did love about your film is the very subtle kind of framing that you used for photography. You mentioned your sister's photography there, Tina, in that you're looking at them thinking, are they at home there? Is that swimming pool his house? And this guy who's kind of clearly made a career out of collecting debts or enforcing things. I mean, they've done all right for themselves, haven't they, these guys?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's probably the reason why they did it. They didn't do it for nothing, did they? Mm. You know. So yeah, I think they've all got what they wanted.
So am I right? Have you gone to their houses? I mean, it looks very leafy and very. I presume we're out in sort of Essex area, are we here?
Yeah, out in Essex area, and yeah, we was in the houses. They've all got, you know, nice houses, swimming
pools, marble bathrooms.
And, yes, it was. Yeah.
Was there a temptation to actually sort of do the hello shoot around the house and kind of look at the kind of taste that these guys had? Because, I mean, they do subtly creep in at the edge of the frame, don't they? They're sort of a marble bust here, a sort of kind of quite rather sort of garish sun lounger there.
Yeah, but I really wanted the film to... if I'd have filmed their houses, then I would have filmed their wives. And, you know, I really wanted this film to feel like you was in their world, you know, kind of claustrophobic in there with them. The audience really has to confront them for as long as the film is playing. So I didn't want any other distractions from that. It's kind of in your face. You know, I did a lot of close-ups. So I really felt like the audience had to sit there.
You do have to confront these guys. They're kind of men mountains, aren't they? Craggy. I mean, they're kind of experience written on their knuckles, if not their faces.
Yeah.
Were you ever scared about asking questions of them and probing them? Or did it take a while? Did you have a set kind of menu for going through? Because when you ask them about prison, for example, they seem to, you know, the tone of the film sort of gets a chill running through it.
Yeah, we did have some set questions set out before, but some of them were more open than others. You know, some of them freely spoke without us even really asking them too much, whereas others you really had to kind of try and eke it out of them. Especially about prison and about crime and that, because a lot of them, as you can see in the film, they're not proud of it, you know, so it's hard to get that information
out of them.
There's
an interesting mix that I found in the film. You think, well, they're not proud of it. They often sort of say, well, I'm not a violent man, a couple of them say. And then they talk about, well, the number of people that they've seen killed, that they didn't do, obviously, but that they've witnessed. So they seem conflicted as individuals, as they think they just do a normal job. However, it does involve violence. We can't get away from this. And Mickey Goldtooth, who's got a heart of gold, is a real character. He's also got a sawn off shotgun. So it's a kind of double-edged shotgun.
It really is a double-edged shotgun, yeah. These guys, I mean, my dad says a line in the film, you know, I thought I was a Robin Hood and everyone else thinks I'm a Robin Bastard, you know, sorry for swearing.
And I think that says it all. They really do think they are the good guys because everything was so within their world. No violence happened outside of their world. You know, they explain in the film that no women or children were ever hurt. They were protected.
Yeah, I expected a disclaimer at the end, no women or children were hurt in the making of this movie.
That would have been good.
It would have. I mean, they really do think they're the good guys.
Talking of the rest of your film career, I just wonder where you go next. I mean, this film, The End, has done very well for you in terms of festivals, got you around the world, got a good release here in England. I was hooked by it. I found the story very intriguing, and you were more and more in the world. So obviously character and story is something that intrigue you, Nick. Where are you going to take this next? Into narratives?
Yes, I am, actually. That's the one thing about The End for my first film. It definitely had to be something I believed in and was very close to my heart, because filmmaking is extremely difficult. So the next film is something even closer to our hearts. It's about twins. It's a narrative, and it's actually written by David Lynch's daughter, Jennifer Lynch. Right. It's an incredible script.
Whose film I saw quite recently, Surveillance,
yes.
Which was a very intriguing film. It was a double cross kind of.
I really liked it.
Yeah, I liked it.
She's
as well.
A very intriguing woman. She's just like her father.
Right.
Yeah.
So and it's about twins, and you two are filmmaking twin pair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so it's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect for us. So.
Yeah.
I'm very excited.
And have you met David as well?
Haven't met David yet. When we go back to Los Angeles, we'll be meeting
fingers
David.
Fingers crossed we'll meet him.
So are you directing it, or you're writing it? Well, she's written it, Jennifer Lynch.
Jennifer wrote it, I'm directing, and Tina is producing.
You're not going to star in it?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Our acting days are long gone. They're over.
If you can call it acting.
Yeah.
Well, it is quite easy to terrorise people, is one of the lines from your documentary. You haven't done that to me today, and many thanks for that.
Good. I'm glad.
And The End is released on May the 1st in the UK, and you can get more information by going to the film's website, www.theendthefilm.com. And now for some of the week's other releases. Fresh from using his ochre charms on Nicole Kidman in Australia and hoofing his way through the Oscar ceremony as genial host, Hugh Jackman bares his chest and his claws as Wolverine, the first spin-off movie from the X-Men franchise.
I said, show's over.
Show's never over for us, Bradley.
Victor.
Aren't you going to invite me in?
Yeah. Come on in.
You know, I've never said anything to anyone about what happened.
Not afraid of dying.
How do you know? You've never tried it before.
A couple of brief prologues set things up. Little Hugh witnesses his father being shot and runs off into the woods to howl at the moon, only to discover that the toothy-looking kid he thought was his mate is in fact his brother. Soon, the brothers Wolf, all growed up into Hugh Jackman and Liev Schreiber, are fighting together in the Civil War, then in the trenches of World War I, then offing Nazis in World War II, creating a formidable team that takes them onto choppers and napalm expeditions in Nam. Like some zealig figures of war, the brothers are then co-opted into special forces units with other super freaks, all led by Danny Houston, on a doomed mission to Lagos. Phew, that's just the first 10 minutes. I thought the idea here was to take one of the X-Men and fill us in on his backstory, but this film doesn't really do that. Okay, so Hugh gets angry and springs out claws when he does so. I think he used those claws, however, to do the editing here, because this is a mess. A plod from set piece to set piece, motorbike chases, helicopter crashes, boxing matches with comedy people in fat suits, and a climax somewhere called The Island, involving lots of growling and crashing through glass and walls. It's hard to take Jackman's sinewy body seriously, nor is his performance remotely scary or witty enough. Only Schreiber, an actor who's consistently the best thing in any film, manages to convince as an evil mutant conflicted by this gift-stroke-curse. Fanboys might be interested, but Wolverine smacks of a franchise too far for this character. Into a different world now, with British film Helen.
Can I ask you to try this jacket on? Could you look to your right? Just like to walk slowly towards the wall and slowly turn back again. Can I ask you to confirm your name?
Helen.
Helen Townsend. Okay, Helen. Can you confirm your address for me?
It's a room here, Summerfield House.
That's the care home on the west side?
Yeah.
It's a great thing that you're doing, Helen. And don't worry, we'll be there to help you do your best.
Helen immediately announces itself as different with a brilliantly long tracking shot of a girl walking through a park. Then another startling shot has police emerge into a peaceful clearing, forming a search line in the woods, cracking twigs. Clearly a murder hunt, one that uncovers a yellow jacket and a handbag amid the leaves. The police audition local teenagers for a crime reconstruction of the disappearance of the girl, who, we learn, was called Joy, and a girl called Helen is chosen. Helen works in a hotel and dreams of reinventing herself, which she begins to do, starting by retracing Joy's fateful final footsteps. This is an unsettling, strange experience and a noteworthy feature debut by directors Joe Lawler and Christine Molloy. As Helen begins to erase her own past and hook onto the future that might have been Joy's, her parents, even her boyfriend, the film takes on an otherworldly air, a dream, a trance, but anchored by a steely realism and the mundanity of the everyday. The cast, mostly non-professional, speak in a stilted, almost expressionless English, while a college production of Brigadoon emphasises the ephemera. The film ends quickly, as if we're waking, but it's a dream I couldn't quite decide on. Was it brilliant, or was I left wanting more? For such a promising film, one with so much potential, I couldn't help feeling that it wouldn't have been such an artistic compromise to actually finish the story off, to give us more. It's rare that a critic actually wants a film to be longer, but Helen, for all its intrigue and style, sells itself frustratingly short, even if that's exactly what it sets out to do. And finally, another British film, Michael Caine in Is Anybody There?
Are you a magician?
No. I'm a retired flasher.
This used to be my room, until Arnold came.
Who's he when he's at home?
He's not anybody now. He's dead. He died in that bed. If you see anything supernatural, do you think you can inform me?
Do you think you can bagger off?
Caine stars as an ageing widower sent off to an old folks' home to recover from the death of his wife and his former glamorous assistant in their end-of-pier magic act. In the home, he meets a mottled bunch of elderly, including Sylvia Sims and Leslie Phillips, and a harassed Anne-Marie Duff trying to run the place along with her sad husband David Morrissey, along with the couple's inquisitive 12-year-old son, played by Bill Milner from Son of Rambo. Caine and Milner strike up an unlikely friendship, the boy intrigued by the old-timer's tricks, while the old magician is enlivened by his new friend's lust for life and his obsession with death. Director John Crowley, who made the award-winning TV film Boye, shoots this twilight 1980s England with great affection, establishing a warm, restrained tone. Such downplaying is welcome and allows the black humour of the setting to shine through with neat details such as Morris's Greenwood-era England top and footballer's tash getting smiles rather than laughs. But there's something not wholly successful here in the skirting around the real issues of death. It's neither funny enough nor gritty enough. It all feels a little cosy, a bit slippers and cardigan. As Caine descends into dementia, I think we're supposed to be feeling sadness for him, but I couldn't help feeling that this minimalism was a hindrance. The shining star is certainly Milner, who is just terrific and acts Caine off the set in a way I haven't seen anyone do since Gonzo stole every scene off him in The Muppet Christmas Carol. For more reviews and the latest film news, check out the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk/film. New York's Tribeca Film Festival has been in full swing for a week now, filling up the cinemas and bars of Lower Manhattan. And joining me from New York is The Guardian's eyes and ears at this year's festival, Ben Walters. Now, Ben, thank you so much for coming on Film Weekly and for scouting about Tribeca for us. Tribeca, that's down, that's below, isn't it? Below Canal. Is that where the festival is now, right down in the bottom of New York in Manhattan?
Well, that's where the festival's based, and that's very much where its origins are. That is, as you say, in downtown Manhattan. It's very close to the financial district and was very close to the World Trade Center. And in fact, the Tribeca Film Festival was set up partly as a response to the 9/11 attacks as a way of kind of galvanizing some local spirit. But in terms of the actual festival itself, it's sort of strayed quite away from Lower Manhattan and to the point where a couple of years ago there were screenings that were stretching as far uptown as the Upper West Side, sort of north of the beginning of Central Park. Over the last year or two, especially this year, the festival's cut down and cut back quite a bit, partly because of the economic situation. So this year it's a leaner festival. It's got fewer films and fewer venues. And, you know, I mean, Tribeca wouldn't claim for itself to be a major sort of world-class A-list festival. It's not the sort of thing that has tons and tons of major star wattage passing through. And that's the kind of stuff that's really going to, you know, literally stop traffic
beyond the film community. Except for the premiere, of course, this year, which really is what we must come down to, because it did have that A-list wattage. And none more New York, of course. Woody Allen back in New York with a Woody Allen film with another New Yorker, Larry David, at the helm. Well, at the centre of his film. It was called Whatever Works. You were there for us, Ben. You lucky git.
Well, that's right. And that really is kind of Manhattan royalty with, as you say, Woody Allen's first film here. Since 2004 was the last time he was shooting in New York, and obviously, you know, I mean, there probably isn't another filmmaker in the world who's as closely associated with a specific locale as Woody Allen is with Manhattan. So it was a homecoming. Also, as you say, the film stars Larry David, who's sort of the latest in this increasingly long line of Woody Allen proxies, where he casts other people to play parts that, you know, that really seem at least conceived with himself in mind.
So that's right. So he's in the John Cusack in Bullets Over Broadway, Will Ferrell perhaps in Melinda, and of course, most famously from Celebrity, Kenneth Branagh.
Mm. Well, and I mean, the good thing about this casting with Larry David is he's such a strong personality in his own right.
Let's hear a little bit of Larry David doing Woody Allen.
Everybody's life still worth saving, even if it's Christmas? Come on, seriously.
What? You must have a very dim view of the human race.
Oh, the human race. They've had to install automatic toilets in public restrooms because people can't be entrusted to flush a toilet. Come on, flushing a toilet. They can't even flush a toilet.
So that's Larry in the Woody role in Whatever Works. So what sort of film is it, Ben? Is it a funny Woody?
It is a funny Woody. The dialogue is very sharp, very nasty. I mean, the Woody Allen, rather the Larry David character, is a sort of profoundly cynical, misanthropic, nihilistic character, as a former physicist who sort of jacks in his comfortable lifestyle, basically because he's profoundly alienated with the world. But this being a Woody Allen film, he's alienated in a very witty, sardonic kind of way. So there's a lot of very funny dialogue the whole way through. The other characters are also all very funny, very well performed. You've got Evan Rachel Wood as this sort of Mississippian beauty queen, the usual Woody Allen, younger, ingenue, love interest kind of role.
So she shacks up with Larry David?
She shacks up with Larry David.
Oh, you can take Woody out of Manhattan, but you can't take the Manhattan out of Woody.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's Woody's all around, really.
Right. How did the audience take it? Because, you know, this is his kind of home ground, but it's a home ground that's been slightly poisonous towards Woody ever since the revelations of Post-Husbands and Wives. He's never been quite so well received in Manhattan. And normally his patch is kind of a bit more uptown, a bit more Upper West Side. What's it like going downtown into that kind of trendy downtown area? I think that the movie is actually set in Greenwich Village, isn't it, partly? What's the reception like amongst that younger audience, I suspect, that were there for the Tribeca premiere?
Well, actually, the interesting thing is I can't tell you about the background of why it was this way. I'm not privy to such information, but in fact, the premiere was an invitation only kind of event. So there was a lot of press, a lot of industry, a lot of special guests rather than the sort of people who might make up the average audience for a Tribeca screening. So, I mean, this audience liked it very much. It's certainly not any kind of snapshot of how New Yorkers actually live any more than Match Point told us anything about how Londoners live. So it's not anything like verite, certainly.
Yeah, one wonders if that was perhaps always the case with Woody Allen. Did they live like people lived in Manhattan? Did they live like that in Annie Hall? And yet we view these as classics. And reading your review on the blog on the Guardian website, Ben, there was a bit where I think that Larry David takes Evan Rachel Wood and shows her around town. So that led me to think, well, perhaps, you know, he always does. I mean, there's in Match Point, there's a picture postcard view of London. In Barcelona, certainly there's every tourist landmark in Barcelona, and no one seemed to mind about that. What is this, a picture postcard New York?
A little bit. There are certainly kind of hints of that, not to the extent that you felt with London and Barcelona, that he was kind of getting his tourist instamatic out. I mean, obviously he knows Manhattan inside out, but there definitely are still elements of showing off the city. And in fact, that's really the thing that redeems the Larry David character from incorrigible misanthropy, is that he obviously does have this very Allen-esque love of New York City.
I'm going to move you on to another Tribeca guest. It's Spike Lee, a real New York filmmaker, I suppose, you know, alongside Woody Allen and Martin Scorsese. We must put Spike Lee as the Manhattan kind of in his DNA of film work. He was at Tribeca this year as well, which must have caused some excitement.
Yeah, this is actually the first time that Spike Lee's been involved with Tribeca. And he is a very, very New York filmmaker, of course. I mean, grew up in Brooklyn rather than Manhattan, but is very closely associated with the city. And this year, he's actually got two films that are showing at Tribeca, which are both on the sort of documentary side of his career.
He's a great documentarist, Spike Lee. I think people always forget that about him.
Well, that's the thing, is that especially with you know, with When the Levees Broke, the Hurricane Katrina documentary.
Awesome,
it's really terrific. The two films he's got here are more contained. You could almost see them more as records of interesting events rather than argumentative documentaries. So he's got one film, which is Passing Strange, which is a sort of concert film of the musical Passing Strange, which started out in California and had a very successful run here in New York on Broadway, which came to an end last year, and Spike Lee was there to film the last three performances. And then the other film that he's got here, called Kobe Doing Work, which is about the basketball player Kobe Bryant. But this is a very contained film, which is actually very reminiscent of Douglas Gordon's Zidane, a 21st century portrait.
I think Spike on our Cannes special last year mentioned he was going to be doing this, and that he'd seen the Douglas Gordon Zidane film in Cannes the year before, and that he wanted to do the sort of same thing with Kobe. So he trailed it first here on Film Weekly almost a year ago, and now you're seeing the fruits of that. So what's it like?
And that's coming true. Well, he's taken essentially a similar approach, where you're following one star player over the course of a single game. The way that it's different from the Zidane film is that he's also, it's a little more stylistically adventurous. He's got a few more kind of romanticizing shots where he might slow down or repeat or go into black and white for something that he wants to draw your attention to. But also the big difference is that he has Kobe Bryant providing a commentary over the top. So as we're watching him, at the same time, you're listening to him talk about how the game played out, what he was thinking, what he was doing.
You got that jump shot anytime you want it. Anytime you want it. Yeah, anytime you want it, it's there.
It's such an intense game. You gotta have fun. You gotta have fun, tease one another, have fun with each other.
Catch it, go right at him.
Man, this is stuff that we were doing when we were kids. You know, I'm still a kid at heart. I still feel like I'm in the driveway on Remington Road in Philadelphia. I mean,
if you're not into basketball and you don't really know who Kobe Bryant is, does this kind of, you know, does that stop you enjoying the film, or is it an interesting document anyway? Which is I've tried to convince people that watching the Zidane film, even if you don't know about football, is still an interesting experience. Do you think Spike's managed to pull that off, or doesn't he care?
Well, see, I mean, it's probably a matter of opinion. For me personally, as someone who doesn't have much interest in sport, I didn't find the Zidane film terribly interesting. And this is also as tightly focused on the minutiae of an athletic performance. So if you really don't think you're going to get much out of watching someone play basketball over the course of a match, then to be honest, there probably isn't a kind of transcendental reason to go and see this for formal or aesthetic reasons. But, you know, I'm sure there's a range of opinions.
But I'm sure having Spike at Tribeca was a great kind of crowd pleaser as well. That must have energized the place a bit.
Well, yeah, and I mean, having that kind of star wattage, which also has a very strong New York resonance with, I mean, Woody Allen and and Spike Lee, and obviously Robert De Niro, one of the founders and the sort of public face of the festival, that's definitely something that does get a bit of local spirit going.
Yeah, exactly. And you're talking of the sides of New York that Woody Allen presents, a little romantic side. You're, as we speak, you're in a hotel suite waiting for Steven Soderbergh. Why is he at the festival? He's got another side of New York, hasn't he?
He's churning them out these days.
Isn't he? Two Chays we had, and God, doesn't stop.
Two Chays, and we've got another feature coming up with Matt Damon, The Informant, which is coming up very shortly, which is about price fixing.
And that, is that a mainstream
in
feature?
In agriculture. And that's a sort of mainstream feature. The one that he's got here at Tribeca, which is The Girlfriend Experience, is very... short, sort of 77-minute, very quick turnaround, almost home movie kind of thing, which is about a Manhattan escort who's played by Sasha Grey, who's a real-life adult film star.
Is she?
And it's
I wouldn't know about these things, Ben. You say you don't know about Zidane and Kobe Bryant, but you know about Sasha Grey, though, watching her at work.
Well, I've had the benefit of the press notes. So it's basically, it's set sort of in the run-up to last year's general election over here. So even though it's about this escort and she's played by an adult movie star, there's actually not much sex in it. It's sort of more to do with the business, the brand management, if you like, of being a high-end escort. So she has lots of meetings with people who might be able to help raise her profile or to give her business advice, things like that. There's also a romantic side of it where she does have a boyfriend who's a personal trainer, and there's some interesting little understated parallels.
It's sort of amazing to me, Ben, hearing you describe a Steven Soderbergh pitch. You just never know. I mean, it's got sort of nothing to do with the two Che films that he's done, nothing to do with Full Frontal, nothing to do with Ocean's 13 or 12. I mean, you know, never know what he's going to come out with next. I wonder, you're going to be sitting down with him in a minute, but do please ask him what this restless creativity hopes to achieve.
Well, it is a fascinating question, and I think a lot of the things that they do have in common are almost technical and formal rather than in terms of subject matter. So this film was made with now even more up-to-date, refined, high-def DV technology that he used on Che. So he was able to do this very quickly. I think it was a 14-day shoot, quite a small cast, a lot of shooting with natural light, a lot of shooting in small interior spaces.
This is the red one camera, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
I haven't got one myself, you know. I'm more of a Kodak Brownie if I'm lucky.
Right. So it has those similarities. And also in terms of, I mean, he can't seem to tell a story from soup to nuts. It's, you start with the beef, and then there's the starter, and then a bit of soup, and then some bread rolls, and then he takes you back for some dessert, and the chronology is a very Soderbergh kind of thing.
I can imagine. Yeah, he was doing these stylistic Exorcist of Steel, if you like, was it The Good German he did as well. He's been doing them ever since, like Sex Lies and Videotape, really. I suppose that's what his films are always about, Sex Lies and now, Hard Drives, I suppose he's moved on to.
Well, that's it, and I do think there are some interesting resonances, actually, between this new one, The Girlfriend Experience, and Sex Lies and Videotape, his very first film, and just that idea that what back then seemed like a sort of slightly perverse niche obsession with the James Spader character, having this sort of yen for putting people on camera and for seeing how the camera affects behavior and self-exposure and things like that. And, that's mainstream pop culture. That's how our pop culture works now.
Do enjoy the rest of the festival. Thank you so much for your report, Ben Waters. If you see Woody Allen, just tell him that you enjoyed his film.
I'll give him your best.
Thanks, Ben. And for more information on Tribeca, do check out Ben's blog on the Guardian site, guardian.co.uk/film. Also, Tribeca itself has an excellent website, and via YouTube, it's screening many of the short films that form part of the festival. Just go to tribecafilm.com. It's well worth a visit. That's it for this week. Our Facebook group, Film Weekly Fans, is back up and running, so do post your thoughts on any of the films and topics we've touched on today. We're particularly interested to know if you think the British gangster movie really is better than the American gangster movie. Scarface versus Sexy Beast, who'd win between Pacino and Winston? Say hello to my little gold swimming trunks. Do let us know your thoughts. You can catch my trailer trash column and the best film news and reviews in this Sunday's edition of The Observer, of course. Do pick up a copy. But now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, he's back, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.